Hey there, this is Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that is usually slow walking through Dante's masterwork comedy. But this episode is different. I had moved on to the second part of Odorici's speech and on even into Canto 12 of Purgatorio and was just humming along with episodes. And Odorici's speech kept bothering me. And so, although I said in the last episode of this podcast that we were moving on to the end of Odorici's speech, I've come back and I want to talk through some issues in the speech. I want to do this rather casually. I don't think that I, by any stretch of the imagination, have come to terms with it, and I have more terms yet to come to. So, hey, it's the slow walk, so we might as well slow down and look at Odorici da Gubbio one more time, the opening part of his speech. Sorry, hey, you know what? You get the Virgil that you deserve, and I guess I'm the one you deserve. Because I'm faltering and of many different minds at once. We're going to go back and look at Odorici again. Here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to read the first part of his speech again, Purgatorio, Canto 11, lines 73 through 108. This is my English translation, as you well know, which you can find on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. And you can continue the discussion there. And perhaps there's more to this speech even than I'm willing to admit in this episode. So let's get to reading it and then a casual discussion of some of the larger ramifications of the first part of Odorici's speech. As I listened to Umberto, I bowed down my face. Then one of them, and not this guy who spoke, contorted himself beneath the weight that held him down. He saw me. He recognized me. He called out to me, even though he had a tough time keeping his eyes on me as I went along with them all hunched over. "Oh," I said to him, "aren't you Odorici, the honor of Gubbio and the honor of that art which is called illumination in Paris?" "Brother," he said, "pages like those laugh even more because of the brushstrokes of the Bolognese Franco. The honor's all his, and only mine in part. Truth be told, I'd hardly have been this accommodating while I was alive, because the great desire to excel held my heart in a tight grip. We pay our debt here because of just this sort of pride. I wouldn't even yet be at this point, except that while it could be done, and I still had the ability to sin, I turned toward God. Oh, the empty glory of human capabilities. For such a short time the green lasts on the summit, even if a foul age comes at its heels. In painting, Cimabue believed he held the field, and now it's Giotto that gets the cheers, so much so that the other's fame has dimmed. In like manner, one Guido has taken the glory of our mother tongue from another, and maybe someone has been born who will drive first the one and then the other from the nest. The world's renown is no more than a blustery wind blowing from one spot, then another, changing its name with every direction. Will greater honor be yours if you strip off your flesh when you're old, rather than if you died while you still had Papo and Dindi on your lips after 1,000 years have gone by? That's a shorter span of time than the blink of an eye when compared to eternity, and not much when compared to the rotation of even the slowest celestial sphere. There's the passage again, and now some general and clarification points and ways in which, to be honest with you, I woke up in the middle of the night thinking again about the opening half of Odorici's speech before he turns. There's a great turn coming up right ahead of us in which he turns to yet a third member of the Prideville, and he talks about this person in the third person. He mentions someone else who is with them in the latter part of his speech. This is just the part that's focused on him, and it's the part that actually kept me awake one night. So let's get to it. Yes, Odorici and Franco are mentioned by others. For example, they are in Vasari's Lives of the Artists. And I know I said it's impossible to locate exactly what they did. True that. It doesn't mean that they didn't exist. I want to clarify that. They may have indeed existed, indeed probably did, especially since we have a death date for Odorici in Rome. But don't forget, Vasari and others are writing centuries after comedy. The Lives of the Artists is written sometime between 1550 and 1568. That's 225 years, let's give it that, 225 years post-comedy. It's actually a little more than that, but okay. Vasari is picking up Odorici and Franco from comedy, as do many other commentators. They're trying to look at what Dante's written and draw it out. And this is what I keep coming back to. Is Dante writing a realist poem? Is this just a bit of historical accuracy on Dante's part, this bit, the whole comedy? And we're supposed to reach for it and grab for it and pull history out of it? I don't think so. I think that notion that this is a historical reality is undermined by the complete fictionality of the journey. While Dante does grab nodes of history to anchor his realism claims, in the end, we know those realism claims are shaky. Do Odorici and Franco exist? Probably, certainly Odorici, and I don't see why we wouldn't say that there was a Bolognese Franco who was a manuscript illustrator. Sure, there are even some nodes of historical referencing for him. And yet, these artists are incredibly hard to track down after 700 years. In the speech, Odorici calls Dante brother. In older traditions of interpreting comedy, this was seen as a monastic link. Brother, as in the way monks talk to each other. This comes about because of that weird bit way back in Inferno with Geryon, where Dante takes the rope belt off, and some people think, oh, see, he's in monk's clothes with a rope belt, and he says that they threw the belt over the cliff to call Geryon, and this is the belt he tried to use to catch the beast with the gaudy pelt. So Dante must be monastically connected in some way. This is going to become even bigger in Paradiso when we get up to the contemplatives, and it seems as if Dante places them very high up in the spheres of heaven. So Dante himself must desire a monastic life, and this is the way that that brother between Odorici and Dante used to be interpreted. I think that there's other ways to think about this, and I think one of the interesting ways to think about this is in terms of guild terminology. That is, artistic craftsmen guilds and the way they spoke, brother, to each other. And I think there may be a way in which Odorici is including Dante in an artistic brotherhood. That right there is troubling, because how would Odorici know that our pilgrim would ever be included in such a grandiose brotherhood? That seems to say to us that Dante is weighting the scales in his own favor, but it's hard for me now not to see that term brother as guild terminology. I think one of the big shifts in Odorici's speech is that Dante puts the prophetic denunciation, the way the prophet would denounce the ills of the world, oh, the empty glory of human capabilities, in a character's mouth. If you remember before this, this prophetic denunciation in Canto 10 had been put as a kind of awkward interpolation from the poet. We kind of worked around this. I talked about decentering the reader. It's still awkward to have that, oh, proud Christians, and you could become the angelic butterfly that flies up to heaven. It's hard to talk about that as anything but a kind of awkward interpolation, even though I tried to give it a spin of decentering the reader. But here, Dante has put the prophetic denunciation in the mouth of Odorici. Oh, the empty glory of human capabilities, and how fame and is transitory, and how everything's passing away, and Cimabue and Giotto. All that's in Odorici's mouth. And this is an important development. Dante has to learn, I think we can see him learning, how to let the characters in Purgatorio and Paradiso speak the truth without the tinge of irony. The characters back in Inferno had to speak the truth from, Jaco the Glutton through Francesca in The Lustful all the way up to Ulysses. Ulysses, and they all had to speak some version of the truth. But we all knew that they were couching it, tinging it, twisting it. They couldn't do any less, let's take Farinata, than speak the truth. And yet at the same time, they were speaking it so that they could further their own agendas. Oh, Brunetto Latini or Pierre de Lavagna. They're speaking it in ways that occlude it as well as present it. They can't lie, but at the same time, they can still be self-promoting. All of that is got that little edge of irony in Inferno. Once we get to Purgatorio and Paradiso, the characters can't necessarily speak with irony. I mean, I think there's some here. I think that Odorizzi wants to still claim he's relevant, and I think that's kind of funny in terms of the larger speech, ironic in terms of the larger speech. But at the same time, Dante has got to become comfortable with putting the prophetic denunciations and the revelatory explanations of how the world works in the characters' mouths. This is going to become more important on the terraces ahead of us as the discussions of human embryology and the formation of the soul and how the soul forms in air and how there are spots on the moon. This is all going to become important. And you can't have these characters tinged with irony. You can have a gentle irony. Poor Odorizzi, he still wants to be relevant. But you can't have the overall tenor of it as self-promotion, as a way that you spin the truth so that you deny your culpability a la Francesca. Dante has to learn how to do that. And we may be watching him work it out here. That is, the characters in Ante-Purgatory, they don't necessarily get near the truth. They say it, but, you know, they're not oracular in what they say, prophetic necessarily in what they say. They seem more interested in getting Dante to go back and pray for them amongst the living. Once we get into Purgatory proper, we have this kind of uneasy shifting about of the prophetic denunciations inside of the poet's interpolations. But now finally, we have them located in a character. This is a very forward-moving step in Dante's art, not to interrupt the narrative, but to make the prophetic truths part of the actual flow of the narrative itself. Odorizzi is a miniaturist. This is the word often used for a manuscript illuminator. You know, they work in little tiny bits around that capital letter at the front of a stream of words in a manuscript. That's really important to think because we're heading toward discussions of what the new style is in Purgatory, the new style of poetry. In general, the new style is founded on, is practiced in, is crafted in smaller poems, sonnets, canzone, not giant poems like comedy. And Dante is trying to take this new style about love that comes from the shorter lyrics of the troubadours through Sicily and up into Italy. He's trying to take that and blow it out into a much bigger poem. Take the miniature and blow it up. And so that we meet our first big artist in Purgatory as a miniaturist, this speaks at least resonantly with the way the new style of poetry from the troubadours and from Guido Cavalcanti and others, the way that new style is practiced, and Dante himself in his own previous works, the way the new style is practiced is small, miniature sonnets, canzone, nothing on the scale of comedy. And I think that that's important. Here we should also think about Cimabue and the new style in painting. I mean, this is part of what Cimabue was doing. He was moving away from Byzantium and toward, for lack of a better word, a more flexible style, a more realistic depiction. And it's a slow progress from Cimabue to Giotto and on up to Leonardo and Michelangelo and and beyond, right? It's a slow step in art. But at the same time, we can see Cimabue as a practitioner of a new post-Byzantium style. And we can see this new style in poetry, which we're going to talk more and more about in Purgatorio. And you should just think that the first person we meet, the first real artist we meet, is a miniaturist, somebody who works in tiny little things like sonnets.
Let me make one thing very clear about Odorici and the first artist of Purgatory. What I mean by that is the first artist of Purgatory proper, through the gate. We've had other artists like Sordello, the Italian troubadour poet who studied in the troubadour style. And we met him before that valley of the negligent rulers, or the rulers, kings, warlords, who paid more attention to their political life than to their religious life. But Sordello was an interesting case, because here he was, this pseudo-contemporary poet, but he seemed much more connected to Virgil and much more interested in Virgil than in Dante. And while he brought with him problems of troubadour poetry, they weren't foregrounded in the text in the way that artistic production is foregrounded with Odorici. Instead, Sordello is kind of an odd early moment in which the troubadour tradition is being linked to classical, we would say epic, Dante would say tragic poetry with Virgil. And there seems to be a way Dante wants to bridge the modern poetry with a classical age poetry in the figure of Sordello and his interest in Virgil. Of course, we also had Casella singing a song in the early shores of Purgatory, perhaps even a poem that Dante himself wrote. We have had other artists along the way, and we have had momentary and passing discussions of art that are setting us up for these big ones. But through the gate, the first real artistic discussion we get, of course, is with this Odorici fellow. Dante confronts the initial impulse to a new art in miniaturization, while Dante's art is much larger. I'm not saying that there aren't new style works that are large format, but Dante is really blowing this new style out into 100 huge cantos that have lasted us so far several years, with several years to come. Dante is unnamed in the passage as the one who kicks the Guidos out of the nest, at least if you follow my interpretation. And you should know that there are many other interpretations for that strange tercet about the two Guidos, and perhaps one is born who will kick them out of the nest. And you should hear the little tinge of hesitation inside that someone is born, maybe, maybe not, that will kick them out of the nest. You know, my interpretation from the last episode is that that's Dante and the cuckoo and the two Guidos who I named for you and all of that. This is a far cry from the poet in Inferno, amongst the thieves in their Malabolgia, who tells Lucan and Ovid to basically shut up, because I can do metamorphoses way better than you can. I think that there's several ways to look at this, and we should think about it for a second. Is Dante, in fact, holding back on the Terrace of Pride? In other words, he's not named in that tercet. It's someone born who'll kick the others out of the nest. It's couched, it's hidden, it's periphrastic. We have to kind of figure it out. Is he holding back because he's gotten into this part of the afterlife, and so he's feeling the hesitation? Or, this is purely speculative, is he feeling the hesitation of just saying himself, "Huh, dude, you're it," the way Brunetto Latini says to him, "Dude, you're it, go on, follow your star"? Is he holding back because he's a little still insecure with this presentation of the good part of the afterlife, something that is extremely daunting and verges at every step onto the heretical? Or, and here's a really interesting question, are we meant to see a development here? In other words, the poet back in the Thieves was very brash. I can outdo Lucan and Ovid, no problem. Look at what I can do. As opposed to this moment in which the poet is sort of, well, maybe somebody's born who's going to kick those Guidos out of the nest. Maybe not. I'll let you figure that out. There's a hushed quality, a reticence here. But are we supposed to see that as developmental? That is, Dante is learning the place of humility. And if that's the case, and here's why that's hard and speculative. If that's the case, who's learning the humility? It's not the pilgrim, it's the poet. The poet is learning how to approach the material differently, and the poet is feeling a reticence. Now, we can say that the pilgrim-poet divide, as we've said endlessly, is not actually found in the text. And so, you know, the divide I'm making right now between pilgrim and poet is a bit arbitrary, and Dante doesn't draw a completely straight line, a firm border between Dante the pilgrim and Dante the poet, and he crosses that line at will. Okay, fair enough. So maybe it is the pilgrim who will become the poet who is learning this. That is, to hold back a little bit, to pull back. But the line about the nest and the two Guidos is in Odorici's mouth, not in Dante's mouth, which then says it's the poet's fabrication. The pilgrim isn't the one who says this. It's Odorici who says it, which means it's fully the fabrication of the poet. So maybe we're supposed to see a developmental hypothesis behind, with, among, inside of the poet writing the poem. Maybe that poet is shifting a little bit and thinking, I don't have to compete with the old guard. In fact, I kind of have to do my own thing, but I'm kind of scared to admit it. And in fact, I should take a more humble stance to my own thing. It's all intriguing speculation. There are absolutely no firm answers here, but there are various ways to come down into why it suddenly becomes so cryptic, especially cryptic, two Guidos, someone kicked them out of the nest, after a terza that's so explicit. Cimabue thought he held the field, today it's Giotto who gets all the applause, that's so explicit. And then it gets so smudged, so vague, so opaque. And the question is why? The only answers that I think are possible are speculative. And finally, the last and most mind-blowing thing about Odorici, if you just step back from it, is that Odorici is a manuscript illuminator. And Dante, the poet, would hope that somebody like Odorici or Franco of Bologna would take on his own poem. He would hope that his poem would become valuable enough for an illuminator to work on it. This is Dante confronting someone who would, just to be blunt, never have worked on a poem like comedy, because manuscript illuminations were saved for saints' lives, sacred texts, the Bible, various giant treatises on love. They were saved in their work for very important, as we would now say, canonical texts. And that Dante confronts this guy who could be part of Dante's lasting fame, were comedy to become illuminated. Illustrated, and indeed it will. Indeed, the manuscript that's in the Bodleian at Oxford is a beautiful illustrated comedy. Dante's manuscript will get this kind of person working on it, but at this moment of writing Purgatorio, this is almost a hope. This is almost reads as if I'm encountering the person who deals with really important manuscripts, and here I am writing this poem, and, well, I give this guy a lot of space, maybe because I want a miniaturist, an illuminator, to work on my manuscript, or I'm afraid that no illuminator ever will work on my manuscript, or here's a guy who makes manuscripts incredibly valuable, and I'm writing a manuscript. It doesn't have illuminations in it. We don't know what Dante's original handwritten manuscript looked like, but we presume that Dante was not an illuminator. It seems obvious, because it seems as if we'd have some indication of that elsewhere. So he's encountering a guy who would make make comedy lasting by making these beautiful miniatures here on the Terrace of Pride. And either he's confronting them kind of with the humbling notion of this is somebody who would never touch my poem, or with the, dare we say, pride-filled motivation of, hey, maybe this is somebody who would someday make my poem valuable and, dare I say it, beyond death, or at least beyond my own death, since it would have then become a work of art. The fact that the first artist we meet is somebody who illuminates manuscripts in a poem seems incredibly important to the overall, the overall ambiguity that still exists inside Purgatorio. I'm not going to read the passage again. Instead, I'm just going to promise that in the next episode of this podcast, I swear, we're going to pass on to the end of Odalisi's speech, in which he talks about somebody in the third person, another of the prideful. We'll have to unpack that. It's a little historically difficult. It comes back to that bit about using history as an entrance into narrative fictional landscape. Ugh, so much to be said about that. We could beat that horse way on its death, and probably will. In order to get there, you have to subscribe to this podcast. It'd be great if you could rate it, if you could write a review, even like enjoying the walk or nice walk or thanks for doing this. That would be really helpful to me in the long run for how this podcast works out in the analytics. And other than that, we'll come back for yet more Odalisi finally. I promise. Next time on Walking with Dante, I'm Mark Scarborough, and I'll see you soon.